Erev Tov. It has fallen to me to introduce Dr. Marvin Sheikh and to explain why we're interested in what he has to say. I think the second is more important than the first. Dr. Sheikh, for those who are involved in education in America, in Israel, those who are connected to the Avichai Foundation, Dr. Sheikh needs no introduction. Let me say interestingly that Dr. Sheikh is a person who has been able to span all the varieties of Jewish enterprise and to be accepted and honored in all of them. From RJJ, those of you from America know that RJJ is a quote-unquote real yeshiva, to various community schools in America about which he's probably the world expert. I remember several months ago listening to Dr. Sheikh in Toronto, and I was amazed to find that I agreed with everything he said.
Boy, I won't hold that against you.
This shock. I mean, this has almost never happened to me any place that I've been, so I have to reconsider. And I went to Dr. Sheikh subsequently here in Yerushalayim, and I presented him with an idea that I had about changing the world. Dr. Sheikh looked at me and he said, "You're crazy." So then I knew that everything was all right. We're interested in the things that Dr. Sheikh is an expert in. We're interested in moving education in a positive direction, in making things a little bit better for the students. And even today, in Eretz Yisrael, things are changing. And the schools are moving in the direction of privatization, meaning that the parents are going to have a major say in what their children study, because apparently they're going to be forced to pay for what their children are learning. And so it's important for us to listen carefully to a person who's worked with schools, with their development, getting teachers, creating a passionate environment for Jewish studies around the world, because it will impinge sooner rather than later on what we are doing here in Eretz Yisrael. Dr. Sheikh.
Last time I was introduced with so many Dr. Sheikhs was a long time ago when I spoke before a Satmar audience. For whatever reasons, then they kept on Dr. Sheikh, and of course university education is trafe for them. So afterwards, all these young kids came up, "First, what doctor are you? What kind of doctor are you? Fuss doctor, cup doctor, heart doctor." They couldn't say you're a professor or whatever else. And so I had to explain to them that there are other kinds of doctors, and then they were no longer interested in me. I must say that the flyer we have there indicates that Rabbi Bravender is in his 40th year in Jewish education. Years ago, the Gruss Foundation in New York instituted an excellent teachers award. And they asked the presidents of schools to nominate candidates for that award. They gave out quite a few, and there's a very nice monetary gift attached to it. And so I thought that more than just giving a name, that I should indicate why this person was being nominated. The person had been teaching for about 40 years in the first grade. And I said that an excellent teacher is a teacher who, when the summer comes, it's the end of May, June, and it's hot, and you've had the kids for 9-10 months, and the teacher is as fresh at the end of the school year as he or she was at the beginning of the school year. An excellent teacher is a teacher who, after 10 years of teaching, is as enthused, is as creative as he or she was at the first year. And at the end of one's career, an excellent teacher is as fresh as he or she was at the beginning. And the wonderful thing about Rabbi Bravanda, and indicated by the episode that he recounted briefly, in which I didn't tell him he was nuts, but I told him just get a different idea, is that here's a man who has spent 40 years in Jewish education, being creative, molding teachers, molding educational leaders, not satisfied merely of what he has achieved, and what he's achieved is significant, but simply looking for new ways of improving Jewish education, here certainly in Ba'aretz, but in other places. And I think that's a remarkable testament to a remarkable man's career. And that's just one of the reasons why I'm honored to be here this evening to speak to you. Of course, the crowd itself, the group itself, imparts a degree of honor. I should apologize at the beginning. A couple of days ago, I was at a truly excellent presentation dealing with Jewish education, training of teachers, and there was this PowerPoint presentation. And that's become the thing to do of late, PowerPoint presentations. Now, to do a PowerPoint presentation, you have to have at least one of the following two skills. You have to be able to use a computer, and you have to, if you're not going to use a computer, be able to take these pieces of paper and write legibly and clearly so people can understand what you're saying. Alas, I have neither skill. I've never touched a computer in my life, and I simply cannot write legibly, so you are going to be bereft of any PowerPoint presentation. You will have to rely on my words. Hopefully, I'll be clear enough. The subject, as indicated, is day school education in the United States, or even in North America, but essentially in the United States, a subject that I know a bit about. And I'm going to deal first with a good deal, with a number of basic facts, go over the landscape so that those of you who don't have a full picture will have a more complete picture, and then hopefully get into substantive issues. And I expect that the issues that I don't touch on will be touched on you in the question period, and I look very much toward that part of the evening. Enrollment in day schools in the United States has now reached approximately 225,000, which represents steady growth and actually quite remarkable growth. It's probably now growing at about 1 to 2% a year, and so that's the good news. There are two aspects of that which are not as good. If you take a round figure of 1 million children of school age in the United States, so you have approximately 20%, 22% being in day schools, which means that quite a few are not in day school. Those who are not, a large number, perhaps larger or perhaps about equal to the number in day schools, are in what are now called supplementary schools, the old Talmud Torah system. You go to a public school, you go to a private school, and you have either once a week or twice a week or three times a week, which is now more or less going by the wayside. You have classes mostly clustered around the bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah experience. I imagine that within the next year we'll have much more reliable information, actually for the first time, data on the number of children who are enrolled in these supplementary schools. I imagine that the number would be about equal to the number that are enrolled in day schools. And there's an interesting thing here, because if you take this number of about close to a quarter of children enrolled in day schools and another quarter enrolled in supplementary schools, and then half not enrolled in any formal Jewish educational program at any particular time, you have a reflection of the breakdown of American Jewish life. We have, including the Orthodox, and I'll call that the traditional wing of conservative Judaism, you have close to 25% of the American Jewish population. Then you have another 25% or so who are Jewishly connected, either in through organizations or through the synagogues or some other experience, but who see Judaism as being an important part of their life. And then you have about half of American Jews who've more or less walked away from Jewish life totally or are not interested. And as I said, that is reflected in the data on day school enrollment. In these schools, the growth is not entirely new in the sense that the the ambit or the reach of Jewish day schools has expanded. There has been expansion, particularly as we'll see soon in what is called the community school level. But most of the growth in terms of enrollment comes from the high fertility in the Orthodox world, particularly but not exclusively in the two Haredi sectors, the Yeshiva world sector and the Hasidic sector. And they constitute already probably close to 60% of all day school enrollment in America. The Orthodox schools account for about 5-6 or 82% of all enrollment, and the rest are non-Orthodox. But the Orthodox fertility, where in the Hasidic sector you probably have 7 to 8, 9 children being the average right now, that doesn't mean that's the number of children in terms of population averages, because all sectors of Orthodoxy are affected by the singles phenomenon. People don't get married, delay marriage, don't have children, whatever else. So the average per live birth is way below that figure. But the families that do produce children, that's the number of children. And one of the interesting sociological events of the last generation is how the yeshiva world in so many ways has started to mirror what goes on in the Hasidic world, whether it's in dress or kashrut, certain kinds of attitudes. So you see that in terms of fertility, whereas let's say 30 years ago there was a huge gap in fertility between the Hasidic world and the yeshiva world in the United States. A typical yeshiva world family was about 4 children. Now that gap is closed. The children are getting married younger in the yeshiva world, and they're producing more children. And so the gap is much narrower. But in combination, the yeshiva world and the Hasidic world account for a very large proportion of the growth of day school enrollment in America. I should say, by the way, even the modern Orthodox who marry and have children, the number of children is way above what it is for the rest of American Jewry. Probably comes to about 3.2 children per family in the modern Orthodox sector of North America. The non-Orthodox schools are of three kinds. There are a very small number of Reform day schools, 18 to 20, depending on the count. They have an enrollment of about 4,000 to 5,000 children. Then there are the Solomon Schechter conservative schools, and then there are the community day schools. I already noted that most of the growth in the non-Orthodox sector is in the community day school sector. Now, these schools are basically either non-denominational, if you will, or trans-denominational. They become very popular, and indeed, again reflecting something on the outside, as the conservative movement in North America, and particularly in the United States, has been under a great deal of pressure and has lost enrollment. Despite the overall enrollment in day schools in the United States, the Solomon Schechter schools lost enrollment, and they continue to lose enrollment, reflecting, again, the fact that the more traditional wing of the conservatives has even moved to some extent into modern Orthodoxy, or more importantly, that much of the conservative membership has moved away from tradition to one extent or another, and more in line with what one finds in Reform families. So there's less interest there. About 6 or 7 conservative day schools have closed down in the relatively recent period. Some have been replaced by community day schools, and some just not been replaced at all. In the trans-denominational schools, if it's of any interest, you have a wide variety in terms of the Judaic component. You have some community day schools that are very close to Orthodoxy. There was one in Florida, which has changed, which was a very large one. Hillel in North Miami Beach, if those of you know North Miami Beach, which had a totally Orthodox ambiance, at least until recently. And then you have a number of community day schools that have a conservative orientation, such as Charles E. Smith School in the Washington, D.C. area, and then you have some that are Reform day schools, such as the Millikan High School in Los Angeles, and then you have actually several which have a Reconstructionist thing. There are no Reconstructionist day schools in North America, but Reconstructionism, and just as an aside, is in a certain sense, in a practical sense, not in a denominational sense, not in a membership sense, but Reconstructionism which means essentially that you, that Judaism is a smorgasbord, that you pick out whatever you want, and that's legitimate. And Reconstructionism is probably, in an action sense, the most vibrant sector of American Jewry in terms of identification, in terms of growth. And you have that in the day school world as well. You have a school in Cleveland called the Agnon School, which reflects a kind of Reconstructionist thing. You have the Gunn School, high school in the Boston area, which has a similar orientation. That is that everything is equal and legitimate, and you you pick. The community day schools continue to grow in number and enrollment. All told, by the way, there are about 800 day schools in the United States. There are different counts depending on whether you count certain schools separately or branches, whatever else. But I have a figure close to 800, and that's the figure which I think is a very legitimate figure. The major issue faced in terms of those who want to be creative in day school education is how to reach out to additional families that aren't affiliated with day schools, so children, send their children to day schools and make the schools attractive to them or make them feel that this is something that is important to them. And that's a process which is difficult because there's part of the secular region of American Jewry, at least for a very long period of time, was belief that public school education is critical, that you have to, that being in public school is American. Not being in public school, being in a parochial school is parochial, is non-American. It doesn't partake of a certain kind of tolerance, which is part of the American Jewish ethos, at least the American Jewish secular ethos. So that there's a huge hurdle to overcome in terms of increasing the enrollment in that sector. Many efforts have been made. There's been some degree of success, but the ideological barrier is a very difficult barrier to overcome, and of course there's a tuition issue because the public schools are free, but even among the very large number of Jewish families who send their children to private schools where tuition can be way above what it is in Jewish day schools, would not touch a Jewish day school. But there has been a success, and the community sector, the serious problem that one faces is something that I've referred to quite a few years as religious purposelessness, the ability to see the school not merely as an institution which is called Jewish in name and has a measure of Jewish Judaic content, Hebrew language, a bit of history, and a few other things perhaps, but somehow tries to inculcate in the students a greater appreciation for a religious Jewish life, however you want to define a religious Jewish life, that tries to do that. And as American Jewry has faced the dual challenge of people moving away more and more, even people who are affiliated, and yet you want to attract them. So the what emerges from that, those two things of people moving away, but reaching out to some of the people who are moving away, is the defining down of Judaism. And that's a major development in American Jewish life. That is, you reach out to people who are further away and moving, actually. So it's a dynamic force of people who are moving. What you do by reaching out and trying to bring them closer to Judaism, what you've created is a dynamic in which you have simply lowered your standard. And that is something that is found in many community day schools. It's also found, very interestingly, in a similar yet different sense, in Chabad schools. And that is going to be a major development in day school education. Until nearly the end of his life, the Lubavitcher Rebbe focused very, very little on day schools. His father-in-law, when he came to the United States, this is just an interesting historical aside, had seen to the creation of a large number of Lubavitch or Chabad yeshivot in the Northeast and in the industrial Midwest. So you had in Detroit, and you had in Pittsburgh, and you had in Boston, and you had almost all major cities of either those two sectors. You had Chabad day schools that date to the 1940s, early 1940s. And then when he died and His son-in-law became Rebbe. There was focus on summer camps. There was focus on Chabad houses and a dozen other kinds of things, mitzvah tanks and whatever else. But there's very little focus on day schools. Very few Chabad day schools were created. Explanation given by certain people in Chabad was that the Rebbe was loath to challenge the Orthodox, the mainstream Orthodox, you would call it, in various places, by the feeling that that would bring criticism to them or whatever else. But whatever the explanation is, there were virtually no day schools created in Chabad until near the end of the Rebbe's life. And in the last years of his life and since, there's been a significant growth in Chabad day schools. And these day schools then reflect much of the reality that Chabad has to deal with, because as Chabad goes out into areas that are less Jewish and tries to reach out to people, there's less of a critical mass of people who, let's say, who will go to shul on Shabbat without driving to shul, as an illustration. So what Chabad does is create an accommodatory system which is different than the accommodatory system of the non-Orthodox, in the sense that whereas the accommodatory system of the non-Orthodox says we will change halacha in order to attract people who are not the Shomer Shabbos, so as the famous decision of the Reform movement 50 years ago to allow driving to shul on Shabbos. What the Chabad does is simply say, don't ask and don't explain, don't do anything. You come to shul, you drive to shul, you're hearing your shul, and that's good enough for us. So they don't lose the Chabad standard. They don't lower the Chabad standard in the sense of what they believe is the halachic standard, but they simply look away at certain realities and thereby become much more attractive to people, because they present a tolerant face. And as I argued over a period of time, more and more their modus operandi in many places is very similar to what the Catholic Church, Lahavdil I should say, had over a period of time, in which there was a clergy that looked one way and practiced one way. The clergy looked as clergy. If you go to mainstream Orthodoxy in almost any area, there's hardly, let's say, in the Hasidic world, in the Yeshiva world, and even in other parts of Orthodoxy, you'll find very little difference in practice, even in look, between the clergy, the rabbinate, and the membership of Chabad. And Chabad is going to be and is a very, very growing force all throughout North America, and of course elsewhere in the world. And without a doubt, it's going to be a major force in American day school education, because it is growing at a very rapid rate. What you find in Chabad is this distinction between the clergy that looks one way, and the membership looks a heck of a lot different, and even more tellingly, because the difference in look is maybe just a superficial thing, but what you have, the reality, is the difference in practice, which is a fascinating feature of Chabad. And it's very rarely been explained, because even if you try to explain it in terms of hoping that you've been makayer of a person by being tolerant, etc., one has to see the results, and in many places the results are somewhat puny. And yet though, they at least have tried to tackle certain realities of American Jewish life that other groups are not willing to tackle. If you look at the two numbers that I gave you, 800 schools and about 225,000 students. So what you come up with is a simple figure of fewer than 300 children per school. And that's a very low figure. Now, perhaps one might say, from a purely educational standpoint, having 300 or fewer children per school opens up an enormous number of opportunities. You don't have huge bureaucracies. You can have attention to individual students and whatever. But the reality is somewhat different, even if it's true in some instances. The fact that the day school enrollment on the average is extremely low has a major impact on the character of day schools. And it's something that just people should not ignore. Nearly 40% of all day schools in the United States have fewer than 100 students. That's a massive figure. And if you take away the top schools, the large ones, Satmo or some of the large community day schools or modern Orthodox schools such as Ramaz and Flatbush and Kafka and Hank and others, what you find is that overwhelmingly American day schools are small institutions. Now that results in several critical deficits which cannot be easily overcome. First of all, the parents who might send their children to a day school, but might not, the fact that the school is small has a bearing on their outlook. Yes, if they have a weaker child, the likelihood is that that school is the school that they want to send the kid to. But if they don't have weaker children, the school enrollment becomes a disincentive. And that ties into something else which is even a more critical a problem. If you spread 200 children over, let's say, just 10 grades, that is, you start with the preschool and you go through the what we'll call in the United States elementary school. I don't know when middle school now ends in Israel. They change it. They attach the middle schools to high schools, then they detach them, and they have all of these reforms, and the more they change, the more things stay the same, but that's a different issue. But in any case, if you have that, what you're ending up with, let's say, 200 kids over 10 grades, is you have 20 kids per grade. So you have one class. Now, if you take a ordinary distribution in terms of competency, what you have is half a dozen or so children who are probably above average, fairly strong, who might benefit much from being challenged and enhancements and whatever else. Let's say electives, you have a half a dozen or so who are average, and a half a dozen or so who are weak. In fact, in many Jewish day schools, more than the half a dozen are weak, because, as I said, there's a greater attraction to kids to get that a small class in a Jewish school. How does a school accommodate in one classroom three different groups? I'm not saying it's impossible to do, but I'm saying it's difficult to do. And it requires a certain approach to the school, it requires a certain approach by the teacher, it requires a certain degree of acceptance by parents, and it certainly requires monetary ability to do this by offering certain extras to the children who need extras, in the sense that they are weaker students. So instead of having, let's say, full-fledged, really special education in schools, in the United States, I don't know if this is the case in Israel, settles what is called resource rooms, which are really very weak, diluted approaches to dealing with children who have special needs in that way. And the parents try to make up for the difference, but there's hardly any resources in any school with 200 kids to really do the kind of job. And I'll get to that at the end, because I don't want to be negative about Jewish day schools, but I want to be realistic about it. It is a very serious problem affecting enrollment, because it's a dynamic force. The weaker parents are more willing to send their kids. The parents whose children have, again, mainly in the non-Orthodox sector, because in the Orthodox sectors, almost all of the children, not all, by the way, go to day schools. But it is a enormous problem in terms of trying to improve enrollment, trying to get more people, because day schools, as we'll get to again shortly, are simply the single best device for promoting Jewish continuity into adulthood. There's nothing in all of on the agenda of American Jewish life. There are other things that can be helpful. Obviously, trips to Israel, Israel experiences, camping can be very helpful. Youth groups can be helpful. Synagogues can play a role, but nothing reaches the ability of day schools to affect the attachment of Jewish children to day schools. A recent article by Stephen Cohn, who at times has argued differently, simply points out that there's a 12% difference between a day school education in terms of retention of Jewish values or strengthening of Jewish values than the next potent device, and that's a very significant difference. And if you do any kind of factor analysis and you try to limit background, because you can say that, well, the kids who go to day school to start out are are more observant, they're more attached to Judaism, because after all, if their parents are sending them to day school, there must be a greater Jewish identity. Even if you factor out all of these things and you try to just figure out as a single element what day schools do, day schools are by far the most effective device, and yet the low enrollment and the ability to deal with the financial realities of these schools is harmful. The finances are a very difficult thing. In New York State, that's not unimportant for day school education, because the New York metropolitan area, that includes New York City and the suburban areas and the near parts of New Jersey and maybe Connecticut, have two-thirds of all day school enrollment in the United States. So it's a very significant thing. In New York State, there's a reform movement on, got a lot of momentum, had judicial decisions supporting it, to increase support for public school education. And so government, under a lot of pressure, recently adopted a budgetary scheme which increases the allocations per public school child per year by $3,000 per child, bringing the New York State allocation to $15,000 per child. $15,000 for a single curriculum. Single curriculum. They don't teach Judaics. They don't teach any other religion. They don't have two programs. It's a much shorter school day. It's not open over the weekends, Saturday or Sunday. They don't have early tefillah. They don't have all the meals in the school. It's a lot of different things. And yet, it's $15,000 per child. There are day schools, some in the non-Orthodox sector, more in the non-Orthodox sector, which charge between roughly $15,000 and $20,000 per student. But there are far many more students who are being educated in a dual curriculum, often 6 days a week, often beginning at 7 in the morning or so with tefillah, often extending into the evening with Beit Midrash or whatever else it is, but certainly extending into the late afternoon, where the course per child is under $5,000 per child. That's enormously, I don't know what the course per child is in Israel, how many shekels it is, but that's an unbelievably low figure, a stunningly low figure. And the average course in the United States, the survey I did, which is 10 years old, so obviously it would be dated somewhat, but we then estimated that it was about, the average course per child in the United States was about $6,000. I don't imagine that it's above $7,500 now per child, day schools in the United States, including all of the non-Orthodox schools, the more affluent schools, etc., because the number of schools that are simply so badly underfinanced in terms of what they do is a staggering figure. It encompasses almost all the Chabad schools, and encompasses all of the immigrant and outreach schools in the United States. It encompasses a good deal of schools in the Hasidic sector, a good deal of schools in the yeshiva world sector, and it encompasses, if you know anything about the schools, for example, in Brooklyn, there, after you get to the main yeshivot, let's say the yeshiva world, yeshiva, Chaim Berlin and Mir and Torah Radat and Torah Tamima, those have been the main schools. You have a second tier of schools, and then you have a third tier of schools, which parents who are less affluent, or not affluent at all, send their kids to, and they have an enormous amount of enrollment in the aggregate, and they just don't have any money to pay for all the things that they need to pay for, whether it's decent facilities, whether it's certainly any kind of educational enhancements. And yet, despite the low cost, tuition as a portion of the budget goes up constantly in yeshivas and day schools around the country. That is, there are two increases, if you want to look at it that way. One being from the fact that it costs more to provide the education. You have to provide, let's say in the United States, energy goes up. After 9/11, there was great concern about security, so schools have to need security systems and so on and so forth. So the cost goes up, and the philanthropic support is going down. The amount of money given to basic Jewish education in the United States is a pittance in terms of the direct help to schools. We'll get to other parts of philanthropy in a moment. So the parents are bearing an ever-increasing share of the burden of running the schools. The attitude throughout almost all American Jewish life, even now in the more orthodox sectors, is that basic Torah education is a consumer product, and as any other consumer product, Ashi lo yarbev, adal lo yamit, let the rich and the poor, as when Anatole Francis, a great aphorism about the rich and the poor, being equal in the eyes of the law, both have the right to sleep in the streets. And it's somewhat similar to what the attitude is in North America, where, for example, in my youth, and if there's anyone here who's that period, shuls would regularly make appeals for the yeshivot and day schools in the communities. That's almost all gone by with the wind. Very rarely have any shul appeal.
Do you mind if I interject a question? Many of us here are from North America, and we're educated in North America, although some of us have been away for quite a while, and many of us here are Israelis with very little experience in the American Jewish. Maybe it would be useful, particularly to those of us that have been away or have never been educated in North America, to just give a very quick survey of what tuitions look like.
In North America?
In North America.
Well, it could range.
They can be shopping to people.
At the highest level, it's about, in day schools, a little over $20,000 now.
A year.
And by the way, this is an interesting thing. I appreciate what I said. At the lowest level, it's ordinary yeshiva level, it's about $6,000 to $8,000 a year. And then at the lower level of schools, it's $3,000 less, $4,000. And you have one school for students from the former Soviet Union, mainly Bukharan students, established by Mr. Levayev, which has about 700 students, which is tuition free. It's the only tuition-free school in North America, but the cost is. I mean, there are other little interesting byproducts which aren't simply known. In the United States, I don't know again the law in Israel. You can have a thing called homeschooling. That is, parents can simply opt out by law. You have to register with the state officials, the government officials, and say we are opting out from any formal school education. We are going to homeschool our children, sometimes alone, sometimes with clusters of parents of a similar thing. There are at least two growing homeschooling associations among the Orthodox in the United States, and they probably have now, I would estimate, between 2,000 and 3,000 children being registered in these schools, in these arrangements. And it's a spreading phenomenon because the parents just simply say we cannot afford tuition. It's hard to figure out how many children are not in day school in North America because of the tuition issue. But one thing which is interesting is that it's not the major factor, and I don't know if it affects anyone here, but there's an interesting element of Aliyah from North America to Israel. Overall, just to interject that and see a connection with the Jewish education, overall Aliyah from North America to Israel is nothing to write home about. And this has been something commented on for a long period of time, because if you take certainly all of North America, you're talking about 5-6 million Jews, and you have a few thousand coming each year. So what does it mean? It's a drop in the bucket. And, you know, the immigration officials here, the absorption officials here, the Jewish agency, all have recognized that Aliyah is very low. But if you take it in terms of a population of 500,000 or 600,000, which is the usual estimate given for orthodoxy in the United States, then the figures start to become meaningful, particularly if you have a young couple coming and then they have a number of children. So while formally the Aliyah figures only show the parents who came or one person who came, but on the other hand, if they have six children, in a real sense, those six children followed what their parents did because of Aliyah. What you have is in the modern Orthodox sector, where tuition is much higher than it is in the other sectors of Orthodox life, much higher. In the modern Orthodox sector, you have significant Aliyah, and what I've heard from people is that clearly the most important element in that Aliyah is an identity, just a burning desire to live in Israel, to experience Israel, to be here. But you have people saying that there are two costs that they escape in America. One is from the yeshiva or day school education, and the other is medical coverage. And you have people saying that, and it's a critical fact because an Orthodox family with four children in day school, and where, let's say, this is true in Israel, where today, almost in all families, both parents are working. I mean, it's a phenomenon which didn't exist in my youth, but both parents today work. So if you have an income, let's say a gross income of $120,000, you have four children in day school, you are poor. You cannot afford a full tuition in schools because that's all pre-tax money, and then after tax you have much less and so on and so forth. So that's a factor. There is a role, by the way, I was talking before I diverted myself a bit in terms of philanthropy. There's been a major expansion and improvement in school facilities in North America. Very major. And the investment is huge, probably approaching $1 billion or more over the past decade. Almost all of it from private philanthropy, not all of it. There are some governmental arrangements which come into play, which we may not explore over here. In all sectors of day school education, people of means have been much more willing to contribute to facility improvement than they are willing to contribute to the ordinary operating budget of a school. So you have major gifts going in that direction, but schools not being able to sustain themselves. So you do have a serious crisis in that regard. There is a movement in the United States throughout the country called charter schools. Until now, there is really no single charter school of a Judaic. Charter schools are schools that are chartered by government to operate under the sanction of government as somewhat public schools, but with a certain distinct purpose. And so that you can have a charter school for Greeks, and they'll teach Greek language, and presumably children whose families speak Greek at home will be the ones who are enrolled in that school. There are some other charter schools throughout the country. The main concept is that public schools are too large, they're too beset with social pathologies, so you need the new arrangements. There are now incipient efforts to do something with respect to charter schools in the day school world, or the Jewish world, not quite the day school world, and they may succeed. They, dialectically, their success will... Dialectically, their success will come almost certainly at a cost in terms of what the overall Jewish community is trying to accomplish. That is, if the overall Jewish community is trying to accomplish the expansion of Jewish day schools for parents who are marginal with respect to their observance or marginal with respect to a whole series of Jewish identities, and now and they have to pay $6,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 or more tuition, and you have a charter school which teaches Hebrew language and a smattering of Jewish history, and the parents say, "Mali atzerazot, what do I need to pay all that tuition? I have a free day school, free public school, which has some Judaic ambiance. So let me enroll the children there." And that's one of the coming issues in Jewish education in the United States, whether you should go in the direction of these schools sanctioned by government, paid totally by government, and yet they have the ability of simply destroying other schools, existing schools, particularly the schools that are in the non-Orthodox sector.
And they would, of course, not be able to teach religion.
By law, they wouldn't be able to teach religion, yes.
There was recently an article, I don't remember which paper, in the last week, about a school in New York for kids, Islamic kids?
Yes. Well, it's not so much Islam, it's an Arabic language school.
So they're not allowed to teach Islam?
Well, they can teach the same thing we would teach Jewish history, they would teach Islamic history.
But they're not allowed to teach Islam.
They're not allowed to teach the religion of Islam. Uh-huh. Well, they can teach, possibly they can get on the wires, they're just teaching the subject matter of religion. History, religion, what the religion requires. but without any indoctrination thing. Separate the two, I don't think so. But,
so that's a charter school with a...
No, that's a regular public school. That's not a charter school. The issue in New York is an Arabic language school, which will be a regular New York City public school, which will teach that language.
And that's second language?
What? That's the bad, well, they will teach English as well, which will be the first, which is really the second one. We'll look at after it opens, and you'll figure out what it is. I mean, you have schools in the country that specialize, let's say, in Spanish language instruction, not merely as a subject matter once a week or whatever. The language, since the United States is a country of immigrants and successive immigrant groups, the issue of language, requiring English language, has been a soft point. 80 years ago or more, the Supreme Court ruled that you couldn't just require English as a language. You couldn't ban foreign languages in schools, you know, not merely as a subject matter, but as being the mode of instruction. And the argument is that you reach out to kids that way.
Yeah, in Canada, it's very popular to send your kids to French immersion.
French language.
Right. You, in Ontario, that's in Toronto, that's the school that you send your kids to French immersion.
Mm-hmm. Well, this school is supposed to open up in September, when we'll see how it will develop. The... Yes? My twin brother, who will be on Friday, is shortly going to be 73. He wears a hearing aid sometimes. I don't wear a hearing aid, but that's so if you that, please, it's just my fault.
When looking at the tuition costs, where does it go? Is it salaries? Is it me? What
overwhelmingly salaries.
Overwhelmingly salaries.
Yeah, but here there's an interesting distinction which I'm getting to. The old line, yeshivot and day schools, had very flimsy administrative infrastructures. There was, of course, a person called a principal. Once in a while there was an assistant principal. You had two office help or so, and very badly underpaid, and that was the administrative infrastructure of the school. Now what you have are, I'll get to that in a different thing, the movement is to borrow from the private school sector by calling the top educator in the school the head of school. Now that in itself is an interesting development, because there is a thought in so many places that if you change the name of something, you've changed the reality beyond the name. And of course we all know that that's not the case. But it has an impact here, because the head of school is not supposed to be merely what the principal was. The head of school is supposed to be a person who has an overriding view, encompassing view of the whole school. And then many of the educational issues, you have a principal below that person, or two principals below the person. Or if you have a lower school, a middle school, and an upper school, you have three principals below this. There are schools with six people with the title of principal and one person with a head of school in the United States. And that's in addition to a number of other things, department heads and certain counseling staffs. Much of this is certainly beneficial. Maybe all of it is beneficial in a way. But it has shifted enormously the cost of education from what goes directly into the classroom to what goes to support what's in the classroom, to oversee or administer what's in the classroom. And that has a tremendous bearing on teaching in America. If you look at, I've done it in the Avichai Foundation, which does all this tremendous research, etc. It's going to publish this thing in a month or so, I guess. I did a survey of 500 day school principals in the United States. People have both the title principal and heads of school, and 400 responded, or nearly 400, so it's a very high response rate. Leaving out the yeshiva world sector and the Hasidic section, the Chabad, because those schools often operate along the lines of entrepreneurship. And it's not to criticize them, because entrepreneurship can work, but it's to simply talk about the mitzvah. That is the family, the Rosh Yeshiva's family, or the Rebbe's family owns the institution. So you don't have the relationship that you have in other institutions between a lay board and the head of school or the principals, etc. So it was limited to that sector. And what you find is, throughout North America, enormous increases in the salaries being paid to the top educators. Not saying they're too high, but in almost all parts of the United States, leaving out the very small schools, and there are quite a few of those, the head of school makes more money than the heads of public schools make in the very same communities. This is throughout the country today. So what you find is, and then if you lay on top of that, other administrative levels, such as there was a protest by a group of parents in a school in the Washington, D.C. area, where just several years ago, the head of school was making $250,000. No principal of a public school in the Washington, D.C. area comes close to that. Then the principals under that man were making each $150,000. So what happens is, what the schools have done is, in a certain sense, rob, and I use that not in a pejorative sense, rob from the classroom experience, because day school and yeshiva principal salaries have not gone up that much. They've stayed below. And the idea is that in most communities, you can end up getting someone. Particularly again, when you realize the fact, again, that two-thirds is just the New York City area. And when you add New Jersey and all of New Jersey to New York, you have all the Colwell wives in New Jersey who teach in almost any kind of day school. So what you have is a cheap labor pool, and particularly the cheap labor pool of women. So that the salaries have remained low for those who teach. But for those who administer, those who teach, the salaries have risen dramatically, and they continue to grow up as particularly schools perceive their ability to do a good educational job as being predicated on educational leadership, which certainly is to a very large extent. That the pool of really top flight heads of schools or principals is limited, very, very limited. So you have rating from one school to another. You don't have in the United States what you had in a previous period, in which people would stay as principal or heads of school in a day school for 20 years, 30 years, virtually a person's whole career as being principal. You'll look at a resume, you'll see that the person has been in a half a dozen places, and the fellow or the lady is scarcely above 40. So it's a remarkable thing, because if a person has a reputation as being good, and schools need good people, so they go out to and try to reach out to these people. And that's very critical for schools, but it has an impact on the financing of schools, what teachers are being paid, the ability of the teacher retention, because you have all these dedicated people who come in and they really want to teach and they love teaching and they're effective teachers, but go pay the bills. Or go register your children at a day school in America or a yeshiva in America where you're not teaching, and say, well, I'm a Rebbe, or my husband is in Kohl, or I'm a teacher, and how can I pay $6,000 a year? Certainly more than that. I have five children in school. My salary isn't $30,000. It's a problem. It's a growing problem. But it's what happens in all situations where the labor pool to be exploited is large, so you simply exploit in a situation of limited money.
Unless there's accountability.
Beg pardon?
Unless there's accountability. I mean, if you're talking about raising money and funding, then there should be accountability, and there should be open exposure of how you know, there should be a limit to how much money should be spent on administration.
Well, I think...
And a checking mechanism. That's the important thing.
Well, you have heads of school. Some heads of school in America now getting $400,000. Which is a remarkable salary. But the school boards, I mean, I don't know how you stop that. You have a limited talented pool. There are a number of creative programs in the United States to train educational leaders. Get the teachers in a moment. And quite a few people have gone through that, those experiences. And I suppose the experiences have helped. Some of the programs operate in Israel. In fact, I think most of them, not all of them, have at least some Israeli connection at one university or another, or one educational center or another, and they've done a lot of good. But there's another factor operating as well, which is that I'll just reach out. I don't believe in secrets. Transparency is the word today, right? Everyone, wherever you have to be transparent. Perhaps we should start this. Perhaps we should start to sum up. Rabbi Sachs, you want to be my partner? What's this? Anyway, perhaps I should start to sum up and move on to questions. I'll sum up in about 5 minutes. But the problem is that if you believe that the people on top are critical, you're going to go out to try to get them. And then the boards of schools will say, there's no money to pay the raises which are necessary for other people, and we always end up having teachers. And there's an argument that people make, which seems to be perverse to some, which is that the fact that salaries are low for teaching has a benefit because it has the indirect consequence of reducing teacher burnout. That is, that people leave the field at... it's an important argument. That is, people leave the field and wait a minute, wait. Look, understand the day school thing. You have these young women coming out of seminaries. You have brilliant young women coming in. You've got to go to schools. I think I've been to probably close to 400 of the schools in North America. And you go into a classroom and you see a 19-year-old girl, a 20-year-old girl, 21-year-old girl, and she's 1 or 2 years at the most out of seminary. She's just gotten married or about to get married or not married yet. And you have some of the most spectacular teaching under the sun. Period. The creativity, the time they put into it, the reaching out to kids, the reaching out to parents. It's remarkable. Remarkable. So there is an argument. I admit that it seems to be perverse that by having low salaries and people moving out of the field, that you have opportunities for these young people to come in. And there's an argument against it as well. I'll admit to that. Rabbi Bravin actually has asked me to speak about teachers. Not merely about the salaries, but the training of teachers and whatever else. There's a lot of teacher training going on in all educational systems today. There is an interesting question as to the efficacy of teacher training. In fact, it's true of almost all professions where people say, you know, what do I really learn in the classroom and what do I learn once I hit the field? And that's a fascinating thing. At least one should admit that, so it's probably could take a middle ground saying that both learning experiences are important in the classroom before you become by classroom I don't mean you as a teacher, but you as a student learning to teach, and then in the classroom when you do teach. But the latter, which is very important, requires certain things, and it requires what you have in almost all fields: continuing education. You don't have really effective continuing education in formal Jewish education. More of that is needed. There's no doubt that mentoring is possibly the most useful device to reach out to a young faculty member who has skills, who has dedication, devotion, energy, and whatever else, but somehow doesn't have all of what it takes to really deal, let's say, manage a classroom. How do you handle parents? How do you handle unruly children? And whatever else. And mentoring arrangements are critical. More and more is being invested in mental arrangements, and they are important. Rabbi Bravin asked me to say something about teachers as leaders, as educational leaders, teachers as community leaders. And I don't see that really. It's a goal. It's maybe a very good goal. But maybe in terms of some other things that they do, there are certain teachers who are rabbis of synagogues, so they can be community leaders. I don't see that as being part of the agenda. I see the challenge facing teachers and those who hire teachers and those who pay teachers. That is both the educational administrators of the school and the lay boards of the school, trying to find formulas where a teacher, on the one hand, teaches what has to be taught. The subject matter that has to be covered in a certain grade, and all the other things that are necessary for that experience, for that encounter between student and teacher, child and teacher. But yet the critical thing is to give breathing room to teachers. And there's very little breathing room to teachers. What I would call the lesson plans, the books that you have to prepare a week in advance, 2 weeks in advance, saying what you're going to teach, and the formulaic part of that, to a whole series of things in which the teachers are not able to bring to bear sufficiently, at least in most situations. Most situations that I know of have seen their own creativity, their own persona, their own self, their own looking at things. And there's a way of doing it. I don't know, my first year of teaching, I wasn't a Judaic teacher, I was a social studies teacher. The good news about that was that was the best one where I met my wife, and I decided to marry. We got engaged, and I graduated high school, and the next day the head of the school outlawed single male teachers in Mankiewicz for 45 years, as we're saying, that he's a day too late, but that's a different story. But in my first year, I was teaching social studies, I was teaching American history. And we, you know, so you have the book on the section on the Revolutionary War in the United States. So now that the history textbooks are small text, they have a lot of pictures, they have big type. They say three reasons for the Revolutionary War. And the teacher, you know, looks at the book, three reasons for the Revolutionary War, so if that's what teaching is about, that you simply mouth what the textbook is. So what I did simply then, this is about close to 50 years ago, is simply tell the children, each of the students, each of you had to either get hold of a British textbook or get to the British Information Officer and cover the very same historical events from the British perspective. So you learn something about history and how people look at history and other things. I did it because, and I in that couple of years, I refused to hand in any lesson plans. I said, Lo Navi Anochi, Lo Ben Navi Anochi, and I'm certainly not going to do it. But in most schools, there is not enough play for the creativity of people. The teachers are creative. They're bright people. They're far brighter than other people. They do a heck of a job. Think of almost every other kind of profession in which people have, you know, easy time. Whether in the office because the boss is not in, or the, whatever else, or you're alert, you're alive in a classroom with 10, 20, 30 kids, whatever else. You're challenged every moment. And the reciprocal of that should be that teachers, that's to me one of the most important things for education reform. Let the teachers breathe, let them be creative. Let them, in fact, not in terms of God forbid, in disciplinary areas or just mouthing out their own silly things, but in the educational domain, let them be themselves, let them risk, let them think out of the box, let them teach out of the box. Let them teach out of the box. Let them not worry about every little thing that's in that textbook, which the kid can read anyway. And that is a challenge. How do we deal with that challenge is something I don't know, because clearly there were parents who'd be dissatisfied with the fact that the teacher was creative, and there'd be maybe students who don't do that well under the system, or there'd be lay people who don't like, or the educational administrators don't like. It's a challenge. It's difficult. It's not a challenge. It's more than a challenge. But it's necessary, because kids are inspired. Connect with teachers. They see, the kids sense when a teacher is doing something special. They know it. Kids at a very young age know when the teacher's going through the routine, just doing something. So some kids can survive in that environment, others don't. I want to conclude about making the following point on Jewish day schools. Schools are the most maligned institutions in virtually any society. Their track record is better than hospitals. We have life and death things where medication can be the wrong medication, where people aren't attentive, where a person can lie in a bed calling for help or needing help, etc. All of the things that one experiences in those institutions, other institutions, schools on the line, teachers on the line. And there's not sufficient appreciation of the dedication and the goodness that is achieved. And they're maligned for good reasons. Here too a dialectic is at work. Because so much hope is placed in a school, in the outcome of education. Because education brings light and success and the ability to function well into adulthood. So education is so important. So parents today, who are unlike parents in an earlier generation, are not really parents to the kids. They're big brothers and big sisters. They're big sisters in most cases. The connection between parents in the present period to what happens to the kid in yeshiva, as against 30 years ago, where parents, thank God that my kid is in yeshiva. So came home and the Rebbe hit the kid, and he told the parents the Rebbe hit the kid, the parent hit the kid saying the Rebbe must be right and you must be wrong. So the parents are on top of everything, which can be good but can be very bad. But so there's a lot of insufficient appreciation. But think of the following, you can look at all the problems of schools that aren't maintained properly because the facilities aren't good enough. Those that don't care enough about the weaker students, those who don't have access to strong students. A teacher who said something inappropriate at a particular time. Think of all the things that you can think of, and the list is endless, about what our schools do wrong, or could do wrong. But think about the following. The three great accomplishments of day schools, at least in the country I am in, three great accomplishments. First of all, they promote the opportunity for Jewish connectedness, continuity into adulthood throughout life in a very significant way. Not in all cases, particularly not when they're educating children from a background which isn't sufficiently Jewish. But there's certainly the Jewish future, the Jewish prospect is more allowed, more freedom in these schools. That's a major accomplishment. It's not formal education, in a sense, but it's education into life. It's what life is about. That's the first thing. Second of all, the religious schools are far more free, not totally free given the world we live in, of social pathologies. And that's critical. You have just a better environment. And that's also not formal education. But think about it. In a world where a drug environment is in too many places, where promiscuity of one kind or another is in too many places. So think about that. Not that schools are free of all problems, but the risk factor is so much diminished, and you have so much better opportunity for life. And the third thing, and this is formal education, I can think about so many limited yeshivot. Let's say in secular studies, there was hardly a secular studies program, as you may know, in yeshivas in America, and not the time for Rimi Bekol has diminished enormously because you have to learn Gemara, you have to learn this, or this is great, whatever else. And think about the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of doctors from that community, in a small community, the hundreds and hundreds of the lawyers, the hundreds of professionals, people in life. Why? Why can you have kids who go straight from yeshiva to a major law school? And that is a regular experience. Straight from yeshiva. That's all you would do. You went from high school, or to home, into a great midrash, you never went to any college, a university, and then you go to a law school. The law school accepts you. Because what the yeshiva does is create, in some mystical fashion, a wonderful learning environment, a study environment. It's an environment where somehow your measure of success is your willingness to learn, to study, whether it's chavrusa study, or read books on your own, even things over the net. You have a kind of surrogate education being accomplished in these schools in which people simply learn that learning is important, studying is important, reading is important, and so many more succeed in life. So we can look at all the weaknesses of our schools, and yet at the end of the day, their achievements are glorious. And their achievements are glorious because, in the main, most of the teachers have worked hard, very hard when you consider what they're being paid. And they've been created within the bounds of the school. Perhaps they should be more creative, or be allowed to be more creative. But they've done wonderful work, and that's what education is about. It's the most glorious experience. Unfortunately, it's not sufficiently appreciated. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question.
Can I ask a question? Yes. I'm recording. I only steal small.
But it accumulates.
Oh, accumulates. Prudent, Mr.
That's right. Well, you mentioned several times, I think, that the distribution of funds is sometimes not appropriate. On the one hand, there are billions of dollars being spent on facilities, and on the other hand, the pay to teachers is very low. And while it may be true that sometimes a 21-year-old girl is going to change the state of Jewish education, it's often true that in a school where the 8th grade Rebbe is a big Talmud Chacham, that has a greater effect on most of the students. Now, today it seems to me there are two things that people are willing to give money to. And one is buildings, and the other is the thing that in Israel is called kiruv. I don't know what it's called in America.
Outreach.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I meant. No, I meant that same word. How do you say that word in America?
Kiruv?
Yeah. In Israel, they say mil'el.
Okay.
Israelis, okay. When they want to say that something is foreign to them, they say it mil'el. So they say kiruv. This idea that spending money to have people run around on a university campus, the chance that they will be able to fish out a potential great Jewish scholar, is worth more
than fixing a school that has 300 kids in it, who are producing every year in the eighth grade, kids who just leave their Jewish experience. I mean, how do you change that attitude? I think it should be changed, but I don't know how to change it. I don't know why the buildings and the administrators are more important than the teachers at the end of the day.
The building is important. I mean, first of all, if you're going to reach out to people who otherwise might not send their children to a day school, certainly a building is important. A building is important for schools that have experiencing enrollment and growth. Building's important because of the health and safety codes. There's far more enforcement of these codes than there was in my youth. I mean, I went into yeshivas with awful conditions, which I attended, and it's not tolerated. So building is important, and you know, Kodesh Baruch Hu should bless the people who support that. There are other issues on financing. You have an interesting point about you know, going to a college campus. You start off with a community that takes seriously, and rightfully, I suppose, to an extent, the Talmud Bavli version of the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, Hamatzel Nefesh Achat Mi'Yisrael. So they take it seriously. They take it seriously. Rabbi Buchwald has estimated that every kiruv work in the United States is successfully acquired about one half a person on the average per year. So from a financial cost-benefit thing, it's very low, but the community believes Hamatzel Nefesh Achas.
What about the kid in day school?
But you know
he's
what?
Also a Nefesh.
The answer is, I put this now in several articles, and there's an article which amazingly will appear in the Agudath Israel magazine in about 2 weeks. So I tell the Orthodox world that it's okay. You look at the first part of the Mishnah, but there's another clause in that Mishnah which says v'ha'ma'abed nefesh achat Yisrael. So you cause one life to be lost. And in schools, there are schools that cause one life to be lost. Rabbi Brahman made a point which I probably should have made, and that is that for many of the schools, the transition from the 8th grade to the 9th grade exists because you do move from the 8th grade to 9th grade, but it's from the Jewish school to a non-Jewish school. And that's an important point. We're losing kids. In Kiruv in North America, it's very hard to get Kiruv data in North America. It's very hard to get a lot of demographic data for reasons we don't have to go into here. But there's now unanimity that even among Orthodox families, there are more children moving away from Orthodoxy than are being attracted to Orthodoxy, and that the gap is growing. So it's a problem. Education is not the only answer to that. We're in a wide open world, and you know, kids can pick and choose. But education can play a role in that, and there is a problem. There is a problem. How do you do it? The article which will appear in Jewish Observer had the original title of "The Shame of the Orthodox," which was a direct attack against the Rosh Yeshiva in America and the Yeshiva world, arguing that they had rejected the 2,000-year teaching of Yeshua ben Gamla, which had never been rejected in any community, anywhere on the face of the earth, until the recent period in North America, which was that basic Torah education for Tinoket Shel Bat Rabbim is not merely a parental responsibility, but it's also a communal responsibility. That had been accepted for 2,000 years without challenge. 2,000 years without challenge. That was, I virtually would say, the halacha. And then all of a sudden it became that it's a parental responsibility. And I met with one Rosh Yeshiva not long ago in Israel, actually. He asked to see me. The American Rosh Yeshiva was here. And I said that it's been at least 10 years since the Rosh Yeshiva in America said that it's an obligation it's a tzedakah obligation to give to basic Torah education. So we're shooting ourselves in the foot. There's no question about it. We should do more. But you ask me what I think can be done. It's nothing that's going to change overnight. The people who have money, and there's now an extraordinary Orthodox affluence in North America, extraordinary affluence, and there are people who give enormous amounts of tzedakah, but they don't want to support this. They'll support, as you say, something here. I support the best kollel in the world. I'm president of four institutions. One of them is three of them are elementary schools, which, or Beit Sefer. One is for boys alone, one is for girls, and one is a kind of curative school for 420 students. And how that combination came about, you don't know. I don't. And then the fourth school is what we'll call a black hat yeshiva. In near Rutgers University, we have a high school, we have a Beit Midrash, we have a kollel. And while the boys are in the Beit Midrash, they don't go to college then. And I sat at the yeshiva dinner 3 years ago, and I did escape with my life, but barely. I said it in Yiddish, but I'll say it in English. I said, if someone would establish a kollel for 10 monkeys, the Rosh Yeshivas would issue a kol kori saying that it's a chov kadosh to support that kollel. And if you went to the Rosh Yeshiva and said, Zezen and monkeys, what are you supporting? So the Rosh Yeshiva will answer, faith, Zezen and Tzakelo, Mustis and Akelo. That's how they would answer. So our priorities are shot. And there's no Rachmanis. What about the families of the poor families? In Israel for sure, but in North America, there's a huge income gap in Orthodox life. And so there's no obligation to support those who just don't have the means. Now I'll tell you where the downfall came. It started about 25 years ago, and I was the only person to protest it. The Rosh Yeshiva in America met to decide a question that arose in Los Angeles. And in a section where in each driveway there were two or three cars, they weren't the Buicks and the Cadillacs or the Toyotas. They were cars that in the aggregate, at that period, cost over $100,000. And the major yeshiva, which is the Torah Semis of Isaacson, which is a yeshiva now of over 1,000 children in Los Angeles, had a situation where they couldn't pay the people salaries. So they instituted a system of kollel families and families in chinuch, which they would give scholarships to, having to say that they'll put, since almost every there were owes a home, you will put a second mortgage on the home. And every year that you get scholarship assistance, let's say you get in the aggregate for your kids $10,000, there's a $10,000 additional second mortgage on the home. And they told the wives, if you have wedding rings, engagement rings, you pawn those. And the Rosh Yeshiva said, muta, because it's a chov on the family. And I objected. I objected strenuously, and I lost. So we're gonna change that. We got our priorities wrong. We got our priorities wrong in terms of chinuch, but worse yet, there is an insufficient understanding of the pain of families. The pain of families. There are other aspects to that. Throughout Orthodox life, of kids who whacked up. There are behavioral problems. There are much greater number of behavioral problems previously, reflecting what's happening in the general society. So the easiest method of a day school, or certainly a yeshiva, to deal with a behavioral problem is you're out of the door. What does it do to a family? What does it do to a kid? I had the following thing that happened in my yeshiva, my girls' school last year in Staten Island. Exactly now, there's a girl, a first grade girl, the most beautiful looking child, who had not merely a mischievous streak in her, but a destructive streak. She would take a pin, and she would stick another girl, and she would do a whole series of things. So the principal suspended the school and said, the girl said she can't come to school. And she was out of school for 2 weeks when the parent called me crying, the mother called me crying. It's a family with other problems. And so I looked into the thing, and the girl was not behaving well. But I said, you know, I don't know if you have that in Israel, but you have a thing called shadows in America. It became a popular thing. Shadows is that's one of the ways the public school system deals with children who have special needs. So a person sits in the room with the child. The government spends billions of dollars in the United States. There are better ways of doing it. So I said, we'll get a shadow. We'll hire another parent to watch the child. And the principal threatened to quit. The biggest contributor to the school threatened to quit. The chairman of the board threatened to quit. And there was not a single person who backed me. Not a single person connected to my own school. And I wouldn't yield. I said, this is what we're going to do, because the child's life is more important. And once we can create a safety zone for all other children. We've done what we can. And I said, the child will finish the school year. And the child finished the school year. And then thankfully saw this other school in Staten Island. On the day that I was going for Israel for the summer, I called the mother and I said, Mrs. Klein's name. I said, Mrs. Klein, let's talk about your daughter. We agree that we'll talk about it. If you insist on keeping her in the same school, I will yield. But it's not a good idea because we'll have to have a shadow, and that somehow detracts from who she is and whatever else. So let's try the other school. And she agreed, and she tried the other school, and the girl is about to finish a very successful year. You try it. You care about kids. What else is education about? But on the other hand, in the recent period, just last week, trying to get two eighth grade girls into Beit Yaakov high schools, I failed. One of them, because the advisor for the school said, well, if you take this B student, you're not going to crack any more A students. It's really nice. It's terrible.
Something that you said in the talk clarified something personally for me. I was teaching for about 8 years in the seminary, and I'm also a clinical psychologist, and at some point I had to choose between the two, and I chose clinical psychology. And one of the main reasons was because I felt that in the two professions, the place where I felt I had more opportunity for continued growth was in psychology. And this is something that you mentioned, and I'm wondering, for example, in teaching, it was basically in isolation. In other words, there wasn't opportunities to discuss how we all taught. I would have liked forums where we could talk about how we talk, how we approach the material, etc. In psychology, you have the opportunity for individual supervision. You can bring a case. You have the opportunity for peer supervision, which is free, where you can continue every couple, every second week for years. You have the opportunity, in my particular training, to go on for a 3-year course in psychoanalysis to enhance the study after you've been working in the field. So that's where I feel like the education makes a big difference, after you've been working, to come back. In medicine, you have case conferences, things like that. But in education, you can take a year to, come and do Melton or, something like that. But in terms of, you mentioned the mentoring, but in terms of an ongoing structure where teachers can have a case conference on a regular basis or share ideas on a regular basis, or there's an opportunity for, here there is a sabbatical year, but not a lot of people don't use it for that, where there's a sense of continuing growth as an educator, not just you yourself, and not just going once a year to a conference, but really in some ongoing way that you do have in other professions.
I'm certain that your career choice will bring great benefit to a lot of children, and so that's wonderful. I think there are two things that might be noted with respect to the picture that you painted. First of all, as the fact that so many of them have family responsibilities and they're so badly paid, there are faculty members who are very good people who wouldn't welcome the burden of the kind of conferencing and interaction you have, because they simply don't have the time, and certainly they don't see it as being something that they're being paid for. It's unfortunate. The other thing is that in schools which, 20 kids in a class, 30 kids in a class, it's very hard, particularly with the sprouting of behavioral problems and social pathologies. It's not easy, but it can be done. The largest day school in North America outside of the Hasidic world is the Beit Yaakov Borough Park. The principal is in his 52nd year. He's the greatest Jewish educator in the world. His name is Rabbi Lemuel Elmerich. He's a giant. What he does in these situations, apart from hiring people to be in the school, to make a large school can do it, he'll take a girl who is a troubled girl, and he'll arrange a big sister arrangement with a very popular girl. He'll give the girls who have difficulty, whether educational or behavioral difficulties, responsibilities in the school. So the school is not merely focusing on the stars, who will become more stars because, everything encourages them. And a whole series of things he does. I can also say, and maybe people in this room wouldn't agree with it, he's ordered teachers not to fail a student. because he feels that the failure will push the student over the edge. You know, there are things, it's hard, that we could improve, we must improve. We must improve. We got to try to understand that it's a child's life at stake. That's what it is. And when it's a child's life at stake, it's often siblings are affected, parents are affected. It's really a problem. But one of the greatest areas of improvements was what I didn't say adequately, is that the schools themselves have to be more tolerant. The throwing out for minor things. I mean, I couldn't have made it. Oh, you take a kid and fit in. My father died suddenly. My father's a Rav. My father died suddenly on Purim in 1938. My mother had four children, ages 3 to 7. And I and my twin brother lived apart from my mother for five years. And we went to public school. So we came to this yeshiva, the Rabbi Jacob Joseph School, which I am now president of for 34 years. And my mother enrolled the child, the oldest. We were in the fourth grade in secular studies, English as they call it in America. And I was put into the first grade in what's called the Mudei Kodesh, or Jewish studies, religious studies, with a first grade. So most schools wouldn't have accepted us. So where would I have been if there was no school? And my twin brother was a very young, rambunctious kid, a troublemaker. I was soft and nice and sweet and gentle, whatever else. He has a different version of that. Truthfully, his is truthful. So I was a troublemaker. I mean, indeed, you're a 9-year-old boy with boys who are 5 or 6. They didn't have the age limit, the age rules, and most of the kids in first grade were then 5 years old. But I was tolerated. It wasn't easy. It was very hard. There was more bumps in the road than one wants to recount, and a lot of pain and whatever else. But the first grade, my first grade Rebbe, who was wonderful, taught first grade in North America for 70 straight years. 70 straight years. Still alive, Rabbi Mandel in Los Angeles. If anyone comes from Los Angeles. And about 15 years ago, my twin brother and I were in Los Angeles for Shabbos, and he was in the shul. And he very worried about the thing about kissing anyone in shul, because he's not supposed to kiss anyone in shul. So he grabbed us out, even after davening, and he gave me a kiss. And he says, boys, can I do anything for you? And I said, of course you can do something for me. And he said, well, I said, the first grade report card that you gave me, I have a lot of problems with it. So his answer in English, in Yiddish was, which became the Smisakin sein. We can change it. You can change it. You can change a child's life. You can change it. You can change it. You can affect it. So I wouldn't be standing here, in all likelihood, had I not been accepted, or I'd have been thrown out, or whatever else. So, the Gris Foundation has an annual meeting of educators, about 1,000, for programs that they're involved in. And in the first one, I was the feature speaker. And not long before that, Congress in the United States had enacted the No Child Left Behind law, which is a major education reform, high standards, etc. And so the topic of my speech was No Child Left Behind, even if he or she is behind. Just think about it. The trouble is that sometimes the only people thinking about it sufficiently are the teachers. The administrators aren't thinking about it. Sometimes other parents aren't thinking about it because they think their parents are going to be, kids are going to be hurt. Reputation is a powerful factor in education as it is anything else. So go tell a parent whose girl or boy is an average student being admitted to a school, high school, that wants to have a reputation for being only outstanding. And the principal says, well, this group, as the principal told me this Per Shabbat, he said, Marvin, the problem is that 30 parents came to me when we admitted an average student and said, we're taking our girls out. We're not registering for the ninth grade. He says, what do you do? So I told him what you do. You keep the girl in. See what they do. They want to hand harm their own children by taking them out. That's their choice. It's just going to try. Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Schick.
Stop Dr. Schicking me. What?
Food.
Food?
Food.
Food is invited to join us for some desserts. It's a kinochim, a ochel, a cafe, a karkak, and a panel arbit. Toda Shabbat.
Thanks a lot.
Sorry?
Yeah.
So excited. I'm hearing a